we're really at a loss for how to develop adaptation policy if we have numbers like aggregate GDP losses around the world of an estimated 3%. To say, like, what is a Zimbabwe supposed to do with a number like that? What is Mumbai city planner going to do with a number like that?
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. We tend to discuss changes to the natural environment in big, global numbers, but the impact of these changes is felt in different ways by different people in different places. So in the latest of our podcasts, examining the policy implications of the topics from the BREAD ICG virtual PhD course in environmental economics, I'm talking to Tamer Carlton, UC Santa Barbara, and Reid Walker from Berkeley about the inequality of environmental damage. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, both of you. Hello, Tamer.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And hello, Reid, as well.
Hello, thanks for having me.
The first question here is, what are we talking about? Are we talking about inequality of exposure to the harms, or the inequality of the impact of the harms, or the inequality of adaptation policies?
The issues of environmental inequality are broad-reaching in scope, and people oftentimes, when they're talking about issues of environmental inequality, are talking about many different things. And so I think the answer to your question is all of the above, meaning when I hear the word environmental inequality, I think about differences in exposure to environmental harms. I think about differences in the way that environmental harms might affect individuals or groups. And then I think about policies that might make environmental harms better, improve the environment, and those could lead to disparate impacts on different groups and lead to unequal impacts or distributional impacts.
And when we're talking about these environmental harms, to be able to know how they are affecting different people in different places, different times, we need a lot of data. So what harms is it possible to model? What do we have the data for?
It's an exciting time to do research in this space because measurement, data, and monitoring, all of these tools we use to do research are changing very rapidly in a way that facilitates us being able to ask and answer questions about environmental inequality. One of the biggest things that has changed in this landscape is access to remote sensing technologies combined with tools and machine learning that allow us to observe for the first time in a spatially continuous basis, global measures of environmental harms, be it air pollution, temperature, rainfall, land use patterns. And all of this historically has required, you know, expensive monitors or expensive survey data to run. And that's meant that the view that we as a research community had was very sparse. Mm-hmm. It wasn't spatially continuous, had lots of holes or patches in our understanding, and certainly wasn't global. And recently, data has allowed us to observe, measure, monitor in exciting new ways. And that's really opened the door for a lot of work in this space.
How precise can we get? And are there some things that we can't measure yet? I recall we've done several episodes of Vox Dev Talks talking about things like pollution, where a lot of the data has traditionally come from high-income countries, but now that's beginning to change, but still there's that data gap. How precise can we measure now? And how complete is our data? Because I know we've done several episodes of Vox Dev Talks, which really have centered on those data inequalities for topics like air pollution, where high-income countries, we know quite a lot about them. Lower middle-income countries, not so much.
Totally agree. There's really exciting changes in data availability, but I think you're right to point out remaining gaps. So I think it's easy for many of us to log on to a NASA or USDA website where we can download high resolution data that looks like it has perfect coverage. In a lot of ways, those data have opened doors we haven't been able to open before in terms of understanding local environmental exposure. But a lot of those models and satellite records are processed and have to be trained to some level of ground truth. And so what you're highlighting with potential unequal data gaps does manifest in these products in terms of how they've been ground truthed in individual locations. So if you look at like a monitoring network of climate data across sub-Saharan Africa, you'll see very sparse records, and particularly sparse records in places that are conflict ridden, that are very remote, that are rugged. And so I think we do, as we keep using these data more and more, I think we want to think really hard about potential biases in them and biases that can be systematic across different groups because of a differential availability to ground truth. And I think we're moving into this space, but there's a lot of really exciting work on algorithmic bias and machine learning more broadly. Like, we've learned a lot about how face recognition algorithms are differentially biased. And so I think we need to do more to bring that literature into space of environment and remote sensing.
As you fill in these gaps, though, are we finding out things that are surprising or important that we didn't suspect before about the variation in environmental harm?
I'll speak on the context of local air pollution. I think that one thing that is becoming well known within the research community and policy community through the advent of this new monitoring technology and remote sensing is just how spatially granular air pollution problems can be. Meaning air pollution, for example, can differ significantly from block to city block, whereas in the US in particular, a lot of the policy of like the Clean Air Act is meant to focus on regional issues, regional air quality. Mm-hmm. And so it's just poorly suited to address these hyper-local disparities in air pollution that are increasingly being observed with new monitoring tools and technologies.
A different angle on this is climate change, where actually the exposure, unlike air pollution, is often spatially quite correlated. So heat waves wash through an area and generally tend to raise warming in a spatially contiguous way. But what we're learning from having access to better data and better computational tools is that the impacts of that harm can look very different at spatially granular scales. So if you are an elderly individual versus sort of a healthy middle-aged individual, if you have access to air conditioning, if you are a student in a school that's taking a standardized test and you have AC or you don't, that can lead to very differential test outcomes. And so on the measurement side, it's been really important in thinking about inequality in exposure, but also in facilitating our understanding of the unequal impacts of that exposure. When we do have some harms that are much more spatially contiguous, that doesn't necessarily mean the impacts are themselves homogeneous over those larger areas.
When we think about policy to deal with environmental harms, clearly we're looking at what's happening now, but we also need to have some idea of what's happening next. We're always being told we're going into unprecedented territory. How do you get the data that informs your modeling when we're talking about what happens next?
Part of this measurement revolution has also been in the spatial granularity of our understanding of climate change. So increasingly, there's work leveraging this data historically to understand how people and societies and economies react to adverse events in the historical record. So what happens when a hurricane hits the southeastern United States? What happens when drought comes through California or sub-Saharan Africa? And we can increasingly, we're able to build up an understanding of what the future might look like by leveraging the data we have from the past and understanding how people have suffered or in some cases benefited in the past. What this picture is generally building is goes back all the way to the answer Reid gave at the beginning of your questioning, which is that there's both very unequal exposure to coming decades of climate change, meaning that largely today's poor populations are going to be facing more extreme heat, more variable precipitation, and depending on the natural disaster, there are a variety of natural disasters that are likely to hit low-income countries in more extreme manner. So that's on the environmental exposure side. But on the impact side, this literature is also uncovering that for any given event, we're seeing a lot of evidence that low-income populations are more sensitive. And so I think of this as a double whammy, where what the future really looks like is especially unequal because you're both getting unequal exposure to the harm, but also we're seeing evidence that these populations are likely to be disproportionately damaged by any given event.
Also, when we're looking at these harms, if we're looking in the same place, is there a different impact? Can we model a different impact for people who have different incomes, people at different ages? Are we able to do this? Do we have the data to do this? And does this give us useful information from a policy point of view?
Certainly today, there's a lot of studies out there looking at differences in impacts of particular exposure to, say, extreme temperatures or to air pollution, and how those differences may differ, you know, across income or based on underlying health or age. Now, I think the elephant in the room and the thing that's much more difficult is to understand why those differences exist. Is it physiological? Is it something that income allows you to purchase? What is the modifier that effectively leads to that heterogeneity or those differences? And understanding the answer to that question is incredibly important, both for policy solutions and understanding what tools or levers we have that might reduce impacts. It's also important for thinking about valuing damages and thinking about the social cost of these externalities.
Yeah, I agree. I can just give a few more examples. I think it's fair to describe a lot of the evidence here, as Reed suggested, as like correlationally, we can see in the data that different populations appear to be differentially affected by the same event, but we need a lot more work. And I think more individual level data, like census data, to start unpacking some of the mechanisms. Mm-hmm. But these mechanisms can look really different in different outcomes. So for example, when you think about health, we see that age is incredibly important in determining your vulnerability. That's also probably correlated with other health conditions. But when we think about labor and workers, there's actually a really interesting Washington Post piece this morning about Miami-Dade County and attempts to put in protections for agricultural workers. And this is because increasingly these outdoor workers are facing really extreme temperatures and are very differentially affected by that extreme heat than I am sitting in my office where I can control the climate. And so that's a context where the same heat event hits my county, but my work is completely unaffected. And someone who's picking strawberries here in Santa Barbara County is going to have a very different reality. So lots of suggestions of evidence, and I think we need a lot more work to unpack specific mechanisms that are going to differ across outcomes that we're interested in.
Do we run up against limitations in data as we disaggregate it, where this increases the uncertainty of what we might project as an effect or an impact?
I don't think I would characterize it as increasing uncertainty. You're right that we need more data for trying to characterize impacts at a local scale. But if you start from the premise that conceptually it's very unlikely everyone's equally affected, then it's no longer clear that aggregate measures, which may appear more certain, are actually more accurate. And so I agree it's a hard task to try to characterize heterogeneous effects across populations. But I think there's an enormous quantity of uncertainty in all of these types of calculations, particularly when you're talking about the future. But I don't necessarily think obscuring what we think is very likely heterogeneity necessarily reduces our uncertainty about aggregate damages.
Well, I mean, the only thing I was going to say is more just statistical, which is that the more data we have, the more statistical power and precision we have. We might find quote unquote effects that are spurious in nature just because we just have a lot more precision in our data. And so I guess we just need to be careful about false positives or multiple hypothesis testing or other things when we're working with massive and large data sets.
The work that you're doing is very informative from a policy point of view, but often there's a constraint in policy in low-income countries that, well, there just isn't money for adaptation. Does that mean that inevitably, instead of adaptation, there might be increased mortality in low-income countries?
We already see evidence along those lines. So, for example, if you look at how energy demand responds to extreme climate conditions today, you can see that in wealthy economies, we turn on our air conditioners to respond to the heat, or we turn on our natural gas heating to respond to the cold, and we are able to insulate ourselves from those extreme conditions. And we can see that in the data. But if we go to some of the poorest regions of the world, you can basically see a flat energy demand response. So these are populations that don't have the financial or technological necessarily resources to use energy to protect themselves from those conditions. So you can see that in energy demand, sort of suggestive that these are populations that are not able to respond and adapt to those events. And then you can see that manifesting in many outcomes, including mortality, but also how workers on the job are affected, how agriculture is affected in terms of inability to respond to those events. So to the extent that we can see that in the data today, that's definitely true. Poorer populations are suffering more under extreme conditions in terms of their crop yields and their mortality and other labor supply effects. I think the question of whether that is the future that we necessarily are signed up for depends on what adaptation policy looks like. So potentially one of the benefits of this research is to help elucidate the magnitude of those inequalities and the enormous potential for income transfers to facilitate adaptation. As we learn more about the role that budget constraints can play in alleviating our damages under these climate events, I think there's more meat behind a conversation about adaptation transfers and facilitating adaptation in low and middle income countries.
Can your work tell us anything about likely patterns of migration in the near future?
I wish I could answer yes. I think migration is an incredibly important and really difficult problem. There's a growing interdisciplinary literature trying to understand what will migration patterns look like under climate change. There's a lot of people and research communities and policymakers interested in that question. It's really hard for a few reasons. I'll just give you one example. If you think about poorer populations, an adverse climate event that could damage income, say through a crop failure, that can either encourage outmigration through depleting any ability to make money in your location, and so pushing people to leave, but it can also prevent migration by eroding savings and preventing people from being able to pay for the cost of migration. And so we see papers finding one direction, finding the other, trying to unpack why we see answers going in both directions. I think there are many other reasons that this is a hard problem, but I think right now there's a lot of work to bring this type of nuanced empirical analysis together with better theoretical underpinnings of how we think migration patterns may respond. And yeah, I'd say top of my list in terms of a really pressing question that we really don't have a comprehensive global scale answer to at this point.
I also think another tricky aspect of this question is data availability. Yeah. We talked a lot about access to remote sensing and satellite-derived data products and other things. At least to my knowledge, there hasn't been a tremendous amount of advances in terms of being able to monitor or measure migratory patterns in granular settings. It's typically hard to observe from satellites and other things. And so we're left with, again, this patchy infrastructure of population movements that may come through survey data or through information about refugee flows or other things. But those are all very, very incomplete notions or pictures or portraits of migration. And so that it's hard to measure and hard to do research in this space, at least in a global sense.
As we record this, we are on the cusp of another major climate negotiation. These international negotiations, there is always a call for environmental justice when we come to making agreements. Does this kind of work inform us about what environmental justice might be?
Environmental justice can mean lots of different things to lots of different people. In the context of climate change, I think one of the primary injustices is that the overall contributors to climate change disproportionately is rich European and Western European countries that have led to a tremendous amount of greenhouse gas emissions and contributed to this global climate change. And then the ironic or really just sad reality is that these differences and impacts are disproportionately being borne by people in equatorial parts of the globe or low and middle income countries that did not in any way contribute to this problem. And so if we talk about justice, it's a situation where this feels very unjust. And this research helps us try to quantify and understand how large these impacts will be in these communities that, through no fault of their own, are having to bear these burdens. So I think that that is very helpful perspectives in terms of thinking about what we in the US or in Europe or in other parts of the world need to do.
Yeah, I really agree with Reid that part of our role here is to put numbers behind some of the things that have been said in negotiations for a very long time. I think it's been no secret in low-income countries that these damages are already being felt and they're being felt disproportionately. But I think the benefit of what we're doing now is being able to put concrete numbers behind some of those estimates. So when you can say one hot day is costing an agricultural worker in this country 30 minutes less of work, that can help change the way that potentially that conversation really looks at these negotiating tables when you have a concrete idea of what we're really talking about. I think the other way to think about the role of these types of estimates in informing policy at that scale is on the adaptation side. So one is about, let me help you understand the magnitude of these effects in poor countries to try to motivate mitigation. But on the adaptation side, we're really at a loss for how to develop adaptation policy if we have numbers like aggregate GDP losses around the world of an estimated 3%. Say, like, what is a Zimbabwe supposed to do with a number like that? What is Mumbai city planner going to do with a number like that? And so I think the benefit is in trying now to help provide estimates that can let those types of jurisdictions develop plans and then hopefully more effectively try to find funding. You know, like Reid said, ideally this is funding coming from places responsible for the problem, but it helps not just quantify the numbers, but then help to think about how to prepare. Because whatever we do on mitigation in the next few decades, there's a big adaptation challenge coming up and we should be preparing for that as well as trying to work on mitigation.
Fascinating work. It's really important work. Good luck with it. I think there's probably quite a lot of it still to do. Reid, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
And Tamara as well.
Thank you very much.
Deep Red, IGC virtual PhD course in environmental economics, is free. And so for more information, to download slides, reading lists, watch lectures, go to theigc.org and follow the instructions there. In this case, I really would recommend downloading the slides because there is a lot of interesting detail. Also, if you want to go to the website of the Climate Impact Lab, and that is impactlab.org, you can find out more about the research that Tamara's been doing. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform, and our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.